Parshas Vayeshev. You know, of the many, many classics, stories in the Western world, the fairy tales we grew up with, at their core, at their heart, is largely one tale. The protagonist was in danger and sinking deeper and deeper. And right at the time of despair, as the fangs of the aggressor were clamping shut on him, closing in on him, he then has a reversal of fortune and lives happily ever after. And we write off that sort of stuff as the thing of fairy tales. Like, that doesn't happen in real life. Well, I would like to suggest we will see in Parshas Vayeshev the unforeseen swirl of divine redemption. How the last straw of defeat can in fact be the first spark of deliverance as a Torah truth and one relatable to all of our lives. Let's dig in. Yosef is sold down into slavery by his brothers. His dreams of greatness, of grandeur, seemingly forestalled, aborted, and impeded. And then what happens? Not only is he sold down as a slave, and yeah, right, he'll ever be king. Then he is falsely framed, incarcerated in prison, and now the odds of him ever reaching greatness are even more elusive. And then our parasha ends with a statement that the royal butler, the Saramashkim, in who Yosef confided and asked to help him out, to put in a good word for him. Well, he forgot about Yosef. Lo zocher Saramashkim as Yosef ayishkechayu. And with that, the curtain of Parshas Vayeshev closes. The curtain of our parasha is closing with agony, with the morbidity of Yosef in prison. And you see the picture our parasha is trying to paint by concluding this way is one of mishap after mishap, elusiveness to dream fulfillment after elusiveness to dream fulfillment. But we, of course, know what really happens here. That in fact, as we will see next week's parasha, each of these disappointments were actually the means of Yosef's rise to glory, of Yosef's ascension to glory. It was because he was in Egypt, and it was because he was in prison and able to make contact with the royal butler, that hence he had the good word to Pyro eventually and he rose to greatness. So here we see redemption not despite setback, but due to setback. Very powerful. Now, we know the story so well that perhaps doesn't make the impression on us it ought to. This is an unbelievable story of fairy tale proportion, but in real life. But let's enter Yosef's mind as he's experiencing disappointment after disappointment and appreciate how stark this scene is. Yosef is certainly not experiencing these disappointments in isolation, but as a buildup. And there's a brilliant clue to this in the text. When Yosef is not only sold down as a slave, but then incarcerated, strike two. Well, how is his dungeon described? So you will see throughout the text, it refers to his dungeon as a jail, a beis ha'asurim, or beis ha'salar. But Yosef refers to it as a bar, as a pit. He says, Gun of Ganavti, May Eretz Ha'Ivrim, I was kidnapped. And here too, I didn't do anything Asher Samti Yosef Babar. They put me in a pit. Why does Yosef call this dungeon, which was previously called in the text, a jail? Why does he call it a bar, a pit? Well, hold on for a second. That expression, bar, pit, does it have other associations in the Yosef story, the expression bar? Is it not an echo back to the beginning of the Yosef story when he heard his brother say first, Let's kill him and throw his corpse into the pit. And then, despite their reconsidering not to kill him, they throw him into a pit. And he languishes in a bar-e kampomayim, an empty pit with no water but snakes and scorpions. The pit, it signifies, represents Yosef's struggles from the beginning. So here, when he's in a dark dungeon, he doesn't see it simply as a jail. He sees it as a pit again. He sees deja vu. I'm going from pit to pit. I am literally in the pits. Do you see how this expression bar, pit in the text, is one of those neon color phrases in the Yosef story? And it's bringing out for us how we ought not study the Yosef miseries in isolation, but as a growing story. The colossus, the epitome of pits, pits, pits in life. And the message is, even in the colossus of pits, Geula happens. Because as we will see in next week's parsha, when Paro reaches out to Yosef, the text says once again, Vayiritsuhu min habar, Paro calls him up from the pit. It does not say Paro called him up from the base Hasoar, from the jail, but he called him up from the pit. The text, I suggest, is echoing for us again the entire Yosef story. Yosef, when summoned by Paro to power, is not only leaving his dungeon, but he's leaving all the pits which he's experienced from the very beginning of the story. The pit with his brother threw him into, and the pit which they threatened to throw his dead, cold corpse into. Beautiful. And this message, that we ought never give up on the greatest misery, might likely be our pivot to salvation. This message is splendidly highlighted in an earlier pasuk in this week's parasha. When the brothers scheme against Yosef, plot against Yosef, and they say, to repeat the verse, L'chu v'nargeu, let's go and kill him. We will see what will become of his dreams. The simple read of the pasuk is certainly it's the brothers continuing to talk and laughing with a cynical, ha ha ha, and we will see what will become of his dreams. Ha ha ha. What sort of dreams when he's killed and flung into a pit? But Rashi cites a deeper midrashic read that says that that expression, and we will see what will happen to his dreams, is actually Hashem, God himself, speaking and saying, oh, you will see what will happen to the dreams. You will see how, despite all your machinations to undermine Yosef, I will now make sure he ascends to glory. So which one is it? Who is speaking here in the verse? The brother with their ha-ha-ha cynicism, we will see what will come of his dreams, or Hashem? It's both. Why does the text weave together two different narrators in one phraseology? We will see what will happen to his dreams. The text intends for us to read God in redemption and the aggressor, in this case the brothers, in their cynicism, speaking in unison. Why do they speak in unison? Well, that is exactly the point. Hashem is showing us how amidst human cynicism, amidst human doubt, yeah, right, is where salvation happens. We should hear the voice of God. You will see the dream happen amidst the ha-ha-ha of all our aggressors who are laughing at us. Yeah, right. Beautiful, brilliant, and an inspiration for us as we all face down our own skeptics and cynics in life. Both the skeptics and cynics from without, people who doubt us, and by extension, those voices we have inside our own head, those voices of doubt, perhaps in some cases because we have internalized so much negative messaging, in some of our personal stories from our childhood. But amidst all that cynicism, those voices from within, from without, hear Hashem's voice. You will see if you only hold on tight the dreams coming through. See how our parsha is beginning to shape up as a beauty? And you know how it works when you strike gold, when the 49ers are looking for gold. When you find your first nugget, you know there's more to come. You just mine deeper. So let's continue to mine our parsha, and we will see more and more deposits of gold coming to light, this theme coalescing throughout our parsha, bringing our parsha together. Because in this week's parsha, we not only have the story of Yosef, but there's another protagonist. We have the story of Yehuda. Yehuda, who fathers his dynasty, what is ultimately the Davidic dynasty, the Messianic dynasty. Yehuda fathers from Tamar in this week's parsha. Appreciate how this glory of Yehuda in our parsha was realized in the most miserable of circumstances, when the dream seemed the most elusive as possible. Because listen to the story of Yehuda. The text begins, it was at that time, Vayered Yehuda me'esachav. Yehuda went down from his brothers, which Rashi says means Yehuda was demoted from glory by his brothers. His brothers, who now regretted having sold Yosef down to Mitzrayim, said, Yehuda, it's your fault. You said to sell him. So they actually demoted Yehuda from his position of glory. Do you not appreciate that when Yehuda is demoted from his position of glory, it seems as unlikely as ever that Yehuda is going to establish the monarchy of Israel. And appreciate the similarity to the Yosef story. Appreciate the parallel lines between the Yosef and the Yehuda stories. They both rise to glory amidst unlikely circumstances. In both cases, they are abandoned by whom? The brothers. Just as Yosef was abandoned by his brothers, Yehuda was demoted by his brothers. In fact, the text, in unmistakable echoing language, speaks of Yosef's descent and Yehuda's descent in similar terms. It juxtaposes the narrative of Vayered Yehuda me'esachav, Yehuda went down from his brothers, with the Yosef hurad Mitzrayim, Yosef went down to Egypt. Joseph's going down, Judah's going down, same story. And we know, as Chazal point out, yet another parallelism. Both of them have a story with a woman who seeks to lure them astray. Yeah? Coincidence that in the two stories, they are both abandoned by their brothers, struggling with the luring woman. Right? Are you beginning to see? These are two parallel lines by design of great protagonists who are going to reach success, who are struggling and amidst their struggles are reaching success. Because in the Yehuda story, he's suffering setback after setback. Read the story. And as we start to study it with more of a fine-tooth comb, the Yehuda story, what happens? See disappointment after disappointment, right? Or see how elusive the dream is becoming at each phase, right? Yehuda first fathers a child heir. So maybe through this child, he's going to continue. He's going to conceive of his royal dynasty. But what happens? That son heir himself refuses to procreate, and he's struck dead. And then Yehuda turns to the second son, Onan, and he says, you do Yibam, you marry Tamar, right? This is perhaps a final hope that Yehuda will father the kingdom. But what happens? Onan, who doesn't want to do Yibam, he doesn't want to do levirate marriage, he's struck down too, and Yehuda says, Tamar, you can't marry my next son because you're not getting along well with my kids. You're causing my kids to die. So now Yehuda has reached dead end. It seems like it's not continuing. It seems like it's not happening, right? No Davidic dynasty for Yehuda. And then what happens? And then Yehuda's led astray by this harlot of a woman. It's all crashing down. Yehuda's physical fortunes, Yehuda's now spiritual fortunes. But unbeknownst to him, it is in that very setting, it is in that very context that he's actually fathering his Davidic dynasty when all hope seems lost. Beautiful, brilliant. Right? Because the story of Malchus Beis Yehuda, Malchus Beis David, is all about ascending to glory amidst setback. As we can trace from one final clue in that story, when Tamar actually conceives a child from Yehuda, or actually children, twins. And it is the twin Peretz, who we know is going to father the Davidic dynasty. But you know, initially that child Peretz has setbacks from the womb. Peretz is left behind in the womb. It is the other competing child, Zerah, who sticks his hand out first, right? And is seen as the winner of the out of utero race as the midwife ties the red string on Zara. Right? But then Peretz who's going to be the true winner here, the true father of the Davidic dynasty via continuity from Yehuda. He pushes his way out from the bottom. And the midwife says, wow, ma paratz dalecha paratz, how you have paratz, how you've broken through glass ceilings, how you've broken through barriers. And so the child in this story, the progeny of Yehuda's name, breaking through boundaries, paratz, breaking through is what the word means. Do you see how more than simply a petty tale of how a child is born and how a name is given on a whim? Peretz is capturing the larger pulse of the entire story of Yehuda. How Yehuda's success is through breaking through opposition, rising above challenges, rising above skepticism when it seems like all his luck is out. That is Yehuda. So don't you see, well, now that we take a step back, our parsha is coming together beautifully. Yosef and Yehuda are in fact running on parallel tracks. Both are achieving their destiny of glory amidst struggle, not despite struggle, but in the moment of deepest struggle. And they are inspiring us to experience setback after setback with this faith as we gird our loins and step forward with a bedrock faith. The unforeseen swirl of divine redemption might not swirl after one setback. It might be setback after setback, but then it happens. And then we see how the entire trajectory of setbacks is actually the trajectory to glory. So I would suggest, and let's see if we can solidify this parsha theme a little bit. Yosef and Yehuda are not individuals, but are the exemplars of rising from struggle. Because let's think a moment. What quality do Yosef and Yehuda share? Who are they? Yosef and Yehuda are, of course, the progenitors of the Redeemer. Yosef will father the Mashiach ben Yosef, and Yehuda will follow the Mashiach ben fathers the Mashiach ben David, the two Redeemers, the two Messiahs. Redemption is all about rising above struggle, rising from the pits. It is no coincidence that it is particularly the two fathers of redemption in their parallel tracks in our parasha who are achieving glory not despite struggle, but due to struggle. Because reared in struggle, reared in rising above struggle, the Redeemer personifies our ability to reverse the tide of struggle and thereby rise from our galus, our exile, whether personal or national. Beautiful, brilliant, resonant. So we in fact have struck gold in this week's parsha. The pieces are coming together so magnificently. But you know, I have a principle when I'm studying a parsha, and I'm cracking open and finding the theme. I believe that if we've done a good, authentic job, yeah, and we've gotten the theme, then the theme is going to be found in the opening topical sentence of the parsha. The opening thesis sentence of the parsha, the opening pasuk or two. And I say this based on what, of course, I learned in my childhood. Were you not taught in childhood that when you write an essay or the like, you need to spell out your idea, your thesis in that opening topical sentence? Well, the divine author Hashem presumably does the same thing. So if we've really gotten what this parsha is about, the unforeseen swirl of divine redemption, how the last straw of defeat can actually be the first spark of redemption, then that ought to be spelled out in the opening topical sentence. And let's see our parsha come alive with this perspective. Let's see how our thesis is corroborated when we open up the opening sentence of our parasha. How does our parasha begin? Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov settled Be'eretz in the land of his fathers. Ela told us Yaakov Yosef. These are the progeny of Yaakov Yosef. Now, the simple meaning would be Yaakov finally settled down in the land of Israel in our parasha after having run from Esav, survived his brother on his tails, and then living in the house of his father-in-law in the last two parashas. Now Yaakov the man settled down and had a child and saw a future through Yosef. That would probably be the simplistic read, but Rashi actually does not read it that way. Rashi suggests Vayeshev Yaakov is not simply a reference to the man Yaakov, but to the nation Yaakov. And Rashi means Vayeshev Yaakov, the Jewish nation, settles in the land of Israel eventually. You know how? Eila told us Yaakov Yosef, because there was a child Yosef who was sold down to Egypt, and by extension the whole nation ended up in Egypt. And then we were redeemed from Egypt, and we made it to the land, and then we settled down. Do you see how Rashi's reading the opening psukim in our parasha in a very unexpected way? Rashi, believe it or not, believes this is pshat, and not simply drash, which is fascinating to me within itself. But my point is, let's internalize the opening psukim of the parasha from Rashi's perspective. The parasha is telling us, Vayeshev Yaakov, you know how the Jewish people settled in the land finally? Through exile. Yosef ends up in Egypt. The Jewish people end up in Egypt. The great irony of Jewish history, that we ascend to glory through struggle. We achieve our stake in the land because of exile, as first laid out in the Bris Ben Absarim. You know how you merit the land? By leaving the land, believe it or not. By becoming exiled and surviving, you will attain the land. That truism is the opening topical sentence of our parsha, is what it's all about. Right? That Vayeshev Yaakov, the Jewish people, will settle down and achieve success. Not despite struggle, but due to struggle. Yosef goes down to Egypt, the Jewish people are exiled. You see, it's right there in the text. It's captured in the opening topical sentence. It's right there. Right? And actually, this notion of the Bris Ben Hapsarim, Avram's covenant and insight, that his children will achieve the land due to exile, is also referenced in the parasha, if you recall. Because when Yosef is sent right into the lion's den, right into the clutches of his brothers, and the pasuk says, "Vayashlichehu me'eim et Chevron," he was sent from the depth of Chevron. Rashi midrashically renders the verse. He was sent to fulfill the very deep idea of the one buried in Chevron Avraham. That he's going down to Egypt to fulfill Avraham's covenant, the promise that the Jewish people will achieve the land due to struggle, as Avraham seals in the Bris Ben Absarim. That you see, our parsha, from the opening topical sentence and on, is brimming and resounding with this theme. Redemption happens due to struggle. This is how we rise above it all, right? How cohesive our parish is coming together as a unified tapestry. And this is what it's all about. And again, it ought to inspire all of us, because I will repeat. We all write off this notion of the unforeseen swirl of redemption, the happily ever after, as the stuff of fairy tales. It doesn't really happen in real life, right? Right, but here we have it. It's a Torah truth. This is how redemption happens in the parallel stories of the Redeemer, Redeemers, and what they mean to us, what they represent to us. And now, by this point in our parasha development, I have no doubt that all over the parasha now, left and right, wherever we bump into a parasha motif, we will see this idea all over the place, set back as the lubricant of salvation. Let's take, for example, a mitzvah which appears for the very first time in this week's parasha. What mitzvah first appears in Parashas Vayeshev? The mitzvah of Yibam, levirate marriage. As the sages observe in the story of Yehuda, when Yehuda's son Er died, it fell upon the responsibility of the brother Onan to fulfill the Yibam and resurrect the deceased's memory. He refused to do it, so ultimately Yehuda does it. Right? Because before Matan Torah, before the Torah was given, not only a brother of the deceased, but any next of kin relative would step up to the plate and marry the deceased's widow. Now, Yehuda doesn't quite know this is going on, of course, because it's Tamar the harlot. Tamar disguised as a harlot who leads him to do this, but she ultimately ensures that a Yibam happens, that her deceased husband's memory continues on when the relative, in this case, the father of the deceased, her father-in-law Yehuda, has a relationship with her. Right? A relationship that would otherwise be considered incestuous, but is happening in order to resurrect the memory, and in context, it's embraced. So here we have the mitzvah of Yibam. Now, is it just a coincidence that the mitzvah of Yibam creeps up in our parasha or in our story? Or somehow is the mitzvah of Yibam integral to what our parasha is all about? Well, let's take a step back for a second. And let's see how the mitzvah of Yibam is not only appearing in this story, but again and again appears within the larger story of Malchus Beis David, of the establishment of the royal dynasty of Yehuda. Because hold on, we know that aside from our parashas Yehuda and Tamar relationship, there's yet another very known, well-known Yibam story which involves this very same family's generations in the future. And what story am I referring to? Megillas Rus, the relationship between Boaz and Rus, that Boaz, a relative of the deceased Mahlon, he marries Rus and thereby sears the child Oved from whom David emerges. That, what a coincidence! We have yet another story of Yibam appearing in the same family. And as with every Torah true pattern, the line just continues. There are countless other examples of Yibam in the founding of Malchus Beis David, this story of our parasha, so to speak, this dynamic of our parasha of Yehuda's kingdom. Because, hold on a second, not only do we have Yehuda and Tamar, not only do we have Boaz and Rus, but let's go back a second and let's think about Rus, the Rus' side of the family in that Davidic dynasty. Who is Rus a descendant of? Rus is, of course, a descendant of whom? Right, you'll excuse me. This is gory stuff. Maybe not the story they teach in Sunday school, right? But what do we know, in fact? We're Rus HaMoavia. She's a member of the Moab nation. Where does Moab come from? Moab, of course, comes from the incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter, right? Now, what is that story all about? Did you ever think about it? Is that not a story of Yibam? Is it not so clear that that is a story of Yibam? Think about it. Incestuous, if I've ever heard incestuous. The scandalous union between Lot and his daughters. Why does it happen? In normal life, would it ever happen? Well, his daughters think, due to the carnage of death, they believe the whole world has died out. They see stone destroyed, and they believe by extension the whole world has been destroyed. Right? So they say, to bring life where there's been pervasive death, the only hope to bring life is to engage in a relationship which would otherwise be off limits. Is that not the story of Yibam? Marrying the close relative who otherwise would be forbidden in order to resurrect life amidst death. Right? Don't you see that so clearly? And don't you see all these Yibam stories lighting up? There are more, but I'm simply observing the three most obvious. Lighting up like flickering bulbs, Yibam all over the place in the founding of Yehuda's dynasty. Both Yehuda and Tamar beginning in our parasha, and then Boaz and Rus, and tracing all the way back to Lot and his daughters. Now this can't be a coincidence anymore. Something is up Hashem's sleeve, the divine author of the Torah's sleeves, in having all of these Yibams occur in the founding of the Davidic dynasty. And somehow this is going to relate to the larger message of our parasha, the founding of the Davidic dynasty, how redemption happens. Well, let's think for a moment what Yibam is all about. Right? Right? Again, the basic story of Yibam. Let's kind of break it down for ourselves and internalize. A man dies without children, which is so sad, so terrible. Right? When a person dies, the hope is they leave children behind who will perpetuate their legacy. When a person dies without children, it's true dead end, right? Dead end. They're dead and it's an end. There's no continuity here in this world. And I laugh, perhaps irreverently, when I think of dead end. Because I'm thinking about, you remember back in the day all the signs used to say dead end? Right? When the through street did not go through anymore? Well, you might have noticed they've changed most of those dead end signs to what? At least here in Baltimore. No outlet. You notice that all the dead end signs are now no outlets? I think people are so scared
effacing down the truism of their mortality. They don't want to see dead end. In fact, you know the funniest example? The old Baltimoreans will appreciate this. I think the I've said this joke in the past. I once observed, I think the funniest change of a dead end sign to no outlet is which famous corner in Baltimore? You ever notice the sign on the corner of Reisterstown and Mount Wilson? Reisterstown and Mount Wilson. It used to say dead end there years ago when I was a kid. Now, when do you think that dead end sign became no outlet? What's at the corner of Reisterstown and Mount Wilson? Saul Levinson's funeral center. That I think they were concerned in a politically correct world at a funeral. No one wants to see dead end. Right? I'm laughing because I'm recognizing human vulnerability that we are so overwhelmed. Because dead end, the truth is it's not dead end. Right? Our children live after us. The Yibam story, on the other hand, is responding, returning to Yibam and Malchus Beis David. The Yibam story, on the other hand, is recognizing the true travesty of dead end. And it's so sad. Right? It is so sad. But yet the Torah says there's hope. The Torah says there's hope. Yibam. That the Torah finds some approach in an unexpected way. Through the most unexpected means, you would never anticipate that there could be a relationship here between the brother-in-law and the and his sister-in-law or whatever other relationship. But the Torah finds a path through the unexpected to resurrect life amidst death. That's what Yibam is all about. Right? Now you understand why Yibam is the great motif of Malchus Beis David, why again and again this dynasty is fathered through Yibam. Because if this is the dynasty of redemption, if this is the dynasty of Parshas Vayeshev that represents success, not despite struggle, but through struggle, seared and reared amidst struggle, that is what the Davidic dynasty, that is what the Yehuda kingdom is all about. So hence, it is this dynasty is cultivated through Yibam. The Yibam of this family, of this line, of this pedigree, validates for one and all that you will father a Messiah, you will father he who's capable of facing down the ever-present struggle of the Jewish people, of the nation and the individual, and convincing them and inspiring them to really break out of this. Because you are a kingdom, you are a king, you are a royal line, a regal line, which knows a thing or two about how to deal with struggle and how to break out of it and attain redemption. Don't you see beautiful our Parsha's greater theme of the unforeseen swirl of divine redemption, how the last straw of defeat becomes the first spark of deliverance, is coming alive in the Yibam theme of our parasha, the Yibam mitzvah of our parasha, and the larger Yibam motif in Yehuda's dynasty, which our parasha focuses on. But you know, if our approach tonight was correct, the way we're connecting the dots, that the story of Yibam in our parasha is not just a detail, but actually goes back to the larger framework which we have constructed tonight. The larger episode of redemption amidst struggle, not only in the story of Yehuda, but in the story of Yosef as well. Then there must be a balance here of sorts. There's always symmetry and balance. If Yehuda and Yosef we traced as two parallel lines of the birth of two respective messiahs, then just as there's Yibam in the story of Yehuda, there must be at least some clue of Yibam in the story of Yosef as well, because Yosef is the same idea. Life amidst death, light amidst darkness in the black of night, as we've traced, when life is the pits. Can we find some clue of the concept of Yibam in Yosef's story as well? And then I will be so satisfied. We will have a parish of symmetry and balance. Yosef, Yehuda, two messiahs. Two rising above struggles represented by Yibam. Can we find any clue, even a small clue? And I think I found it. Because let's think about some of the objects and icons of the story of Yibam, and we'll find them in the Yosef story. Which object would you associate with the Yibam story? Physical object. a shoe, right? We know the halacha is that only if the brother agrees to do Yibam is he allowed to keep his shoe on. If he refuses to do Yibam, the brother of the deceased, his sister-in-law removes his shoe and spits at him. So should happen to the brother who doesn't do Yibam. Because as the Kabbalist explained, the shoe represents the continuity of the deceased for a variety of reasons. So if the shoe is an object of Yibam, how remarkable when we read in the Haftorah on Shabbos that Yosef was sold by his brother for a pair of shoes. Right? What's the significance that they sold Yosef for a pair of shoes? I don't care what they did with the money they sold them. I don't care if they used the money to buy a bus ticket or a plane ticket or a bazooka gun or membership in the gym. What do I care what they used the money for? Now, you might say on a simplistic level, it's breaking out the brother's insensitivity that they just sold him away for the most practical of items, a pair of shoes. But I'm still unsatisfied. Who cares about the shoe? Why highlight the shoe? The shoe must have a symbolism. Well, it does. The shoe is the object of Yibam, which has to be removed off here who does not do Yibam. The shoe is the object of Yibam, is the icon of life amidst supposed dead end. Don't you see that? Don't you see how beautiful? And Yosef is, the Yosef story is in fact symmetrical with its counterpart with the second pea in the pod, the Yehuda story. Beautiful. And I'll tell you, when we trace meta themes in the parsha, it never fails us. Each time, the thread stitched together in a magnificent, a cohesive tapestry, and one cannot deal with a more relevant issue than salvation amidst struggle. Everyone's struggling. I'm yet to find the person who says, no, the struggle thing, that's not the story of my life. Everyone is dealing with that. Everyone is coping with that, right? Well, my friends, how remarkable to close our evening, to close tonight's discovery and journey, if we could just find one text, one medrash in our parsha, that I just want to lay out in so many words everything which we studied and traced in a myriad of ways. I just want to find a medrash, say it, explicit, that our parsha is about how Hashem works in unexpected ways, and when it seems least likely, that is when redemption happens. Well, it's right there in the parasha. Listen to the following Medrash Rabbah. This week's parasha will end with this. The Medrash says as follows. What do you think was going on at the time that Yosef was sold down to Egypt and then Yehuda was demoted from his brothers? It says, Yosef besaku betaniso. Yosef's in sackcloth mourning. He was just sold down as a slave. Yaakov besako tanisa, the father, the dad. Yaakov's also in sackcloth and mourning. He just lost his son. Reuven besako betaniso. Reuven is in mourning because you know Reuven had his own skeletons in the closet, right? You recall in last week's parasha, Reuven really messed up badly, trampling on his father's bedroom affairs, right? So everyone's really, really struggling with a lot of baggage here. Yeah, you think I'm thinking there's one big therapy session here going on in the Medrash in this family. Oh, excuse me, one big family therapy session. Yosef is mourning, and they're all sitting in different places. Yeah, Yaakov is mourning, Yosef is mourning, Reuven is mourning. Yeah, but it says and Yehuda gets married. Yehuda's finding a wife amidst this, like one marriage, a lot of mourning. Yeah? Pretty gloomy, ugly scene. Continues the Medrash, but amidst all of this, Uma Osah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but what is God doing among this? While the family's largely mourning, some marriage, but mostly mourning, what's God doing? While this is all going on, VaKadosh Baruch Hu Osek Bibrias Oro Shel Mashiach, at this very time, Hashem is creating the light of Mashiach, because you don't understand. Hashem is eyeing the Messiah when he's ensuring that Yehuda's going to meet up with Tamar, and they're, right, that here, while all the fury of Gullus, all the fury of Jewish problems that's happening, it's at that very time that God is ensuring the Messiah be born and the redemption both of each individual in the Jewish nation and the Jewish nation as a collectivity. God is ensuring that all happens in the moment of despair. That's how God works. That's the unforeseen swirl of divine redemption, how the last straw of defeat can actually be the first spark of deliverance. There it is. The Medrash spells it out. There we have it right in front of us. Here we have a parsha woven together as a magnificent, magnificent tapestry. Hopefully you all appreciated tonight not only the cohesive tapestry we wove together and the quality textual work we did, but hopefully the message and the meaning is resonant and inspiring to you as we each live this journey of life and face down our own skeptical voices inside and outside, those voices within, those voices without, and plow forward with faith and bitachon in Hashem. Thank you all very much, and warm wishes of Freilich and Chanukah for everyone. Thank you very much. Let me hear everyone's feedback, please.
I have, Rabbi Yonah, I have one more.
Please.